Well, as I said before I read Haggai 1, we rambled around this passage, this chapter, for a few weeks. I want to complete the chapter this morning if I can. You remember last week I was looking at those verses 5 and onward, and you saw that I did something which has been my practice for many years. People who familiar with me know what I'll do. If strangers come in, I am prepared to leave the normal congregation, if I can call it that, and direct my words to them. I work on the principle I may only get one bite at the cherry, so I'm going to bite it. But of course it meant that I had to leave in the main application of verse 5, which is to those who are true believers. I had to leave that, and I majored on the secondary thing, which is there, I think. How do these words apply to unbelievers, to us all? But as I say, the main point is, I think, to us who are believers, true believers. I was interested in the week, I didn't realize this, that Andrew Fuller, some of you would have heard of him. He was the man with William Carey, responsible for the Baptists in the 1790s, going out to India. And these men at Northampton had discussed these issues of the gospel going to the heathen, which was a revolutionary idea in those days. Something called hyper-Calvinism had dominated the Baptists particularly, and others as well, Presbyterians. And they thought that God was so sovereign that if he wanted to convert the heathen, well, he would do it without them. But Fuller had studied in scriptures and seen how the gospel was for all men. We should preach freely the gospel to all men, not just the elect. And he'd written his book and so on. And these men had discussed it, and they were going to do it, and they were going to do it. But nothing was ever done. And this drove Fuller to this text, in verse 2. He says, this people say, we at Northampton in the association here, there are men here, we know it's all right, we've all agreed, but we say the time has not yet come. You see, and he preached that sermon. But it's such sermons as that that broke the logjam. And of course, Carey went to India. And if you don't know the story, you ought to read the story of Carey in India. The one thing, I'm digressing, but I can't help it. The one thing about Carey in India which so impresses me, apart from all his indefatigable labours, I mean tremendous translations into Indian dialects of the scriptures and all the sorts of things like that. At one stage, the warehouse where his notes and translations were being stored was actually destroyed by fire. Well, you just imagine that. You think, well, what did he do? He gets up the next morning and he starts again. Now that's what sort of man he was. He's only a cobbler. But this Fuller was only he was a nobody too. But these men, this sermon broke a logjam on this text. The time has not yet come, says Fuller. It's not time for us. It's a good idea, but not now. No, he said, the time has come. We must go. Remember, Carey said he would go if Fuller would stay behind and hold the rope, picturing himself going down in a pit with the rope. And Fuller gave his life to holding the rope for Carey. Anyway, there was another reason why I didn't take the text last week in the main way, and perhaps it's wrong of me, but I, out of kindness, I suppose, or fear. I know that you'd had a very rough week that week, and I didn't want to rub any salt in your wounds. I mean that. I know what it's like. But there is an iron fist in this velvet glove here and there. I mean, I'm not a prophet. Let me make this very clear. I must make this clear. I am not a prophet, so I don't come like Haggai. I do not know, do I? Haggai knows infallibly, I believe, by God's Spirit. God's Spirit is in these prophets, so they speak, and they can speak to individual people. Nathan can say to David, you're the man I'm talking to. Now, I can't do that in the pulpit. And I shouldn't do it in the pulpit. I should come to you in private, shouldn't I? I mean, it's not the place. So this is a much more general thing. Preaching is more general than the prophet. The prophet can be very direct and personal. All I can do, it's difficult enough to do it as it is to take the principle and apply it to us, to myself as well as you. Now, what is the principle here? I'm in verse 5 onwards. The principle here, we looked at it last week. We saw it as far as unbelievers. They spend their life and energy and time on things of this world. And I tried to make the point to them that they will not satisfy in themselves, and of course in eternity, they'll have no satisfaction at all. The measure of their success will be the satisfaction that they give at death. On a dying bed, what will it really make? What difference will it make to a man that he's climbed Everest? I'm not against climbing Everest, but what difference will it make to a man that he's done all this and that and the other, when he's got nothing else to cling to? What will satisfy in that day? Because that's the start of the rest of life for eternity. And that's the real business. And we saw how the world, naturally speaking, the worldly man has no other heaven but this. So this is his life. Now we are in this world, but we should not be of this world. We've got to go to work. We've got to do our jobs. We've got our homes and our families and our holidays and everything else to arrange. Of course we have. But the fact is, we have a higher business, a greater business to be engaged in. I'm writing something on the moment on the priesthood of all believers. It's only a small thing, but it's a very big subject, but it's only a small thing. And I was at Raymond's on Thursday, and the subject was in the passage there. All God's people are priests. All God's people are ministers. All God's people are engaged in the business of the house of God. And I do not mean the building. I mean the people of the church. Now, what is Haggai saying to this people? Well, we've looked at it, so I can be very brief. They wanted to build the temple, but it was not yet time. Now, I'm trying to take the principle here for us. What is the principle here? Well, you heard me in prayer. We've talked about it privately in conversations. You know what we are talking about here. The cause of Christ in our land, let's say that. The cause of Christ in North Bedfordshire, where I travel. But not only in North Bedfordshire, I can mention Norfolk, I can mention places in Suffolk, I know places, these places, and you know some other places as well. In general, what is the spiritual state, what is the spiritual condition of our land at this time? As far as I can see, declension isn't the word as far as I can see. It's in a dreadful condition, is it not? The temple was in ruins. They wanted to build it again. I mean, I take it for granted. Let me ask them, do you want, of course you want. We want, don't we, to see the cause of God rise again. What do I mean? We want to see sinners converted, don't we? I mean, they don't want to beat about the bush. I'm not talking about raising up, some people have grand ideas about what they mean by this. I'm talking of just two great things. One, the conversion of sinners. I don't like it when I preach and nobody's converted. I don't like it. I mean, you know the story. I told you the story. You know the story of the man who came to Spurgeon, and he said, "Mr. Spurgeon, I never see anybody converted when I preach." And Spurgeon said, "Well, you don't expect to see somebody converted every time, do you?" He said, "Well, no." He said, "Well, that's your trouble." Murray McChain, they knew he was a dying to have you converted. That's what he said about him. When he got in the pulpit, you knew he was a dying to have you converted. Now, I hope the motive for wanting conversions is right. I challenge myself about that. I leave that. I challenge my heart. Spurgeon did, you know. He said, we don't want to be just great soul winners, but we want to see sinners saved. If we do not see sinners saved, the church will die. I move a little bit amongst gospel standard people, if you know what I'm talking about. Now, I would guess that they never see a conversion from the world. How do they keep their congregations up? By having children. And they conform to the doctrine that they're taught. I do not want to see conformists. I want to see converts. I live next door to the Exclusive Brethren. Their congregations are thriving. Why? Because of the number of children they have. They see no converts. Their children are born into it and stay in it and live in it and die in it. But whether they're converted, only God only knows. I'll have to leave that. But they won't talk about conversions. I'm not interested in people being born into this company and living here and dying here. I want to see people born again into this company. But that's the one aim. I want to see the saints really sanctified. That's the second. If you like, that's my two aims. My third aim, if you like, is God glorified over the lot. God honored by it. Now, is it time for the Lord's house to be built? Does it need to be built? Well, we're seeing conversions in droves. Well, I'm not. And I'm not alone, am I? I'm not alone. And the saints are really growing in grace and spiritual knowledge. I'm afraid not, my friend. I'm afraid not. You might put me down as Mr. Misery. Well, do that. I'm unique. Let me be unique this morning. But that's my position. But I know I am not unique. Now, Haggai knew what the cause was. I do not know. But here's God's word. Verse 5. Give careful thought to your ways. Let's examine ourselves again, my friend. Individually. Let's examine ourselves as a church. As a people, I would say this to Ravensden and Wilden and all the places around here. Let's examine ourselves. Let's consider our ways. Not only in my own personal ways, but let me consider my ways. You've done all these sermons, David. You've preached all these gospel sermons. How many have you seen converted? Pitifully few. Now, I am not, although I'm really major on the sovereignty of God. One thing that really does offend me is when people say, well, God is sovereign. Now, what do you mean by that offend? My friend, I know God is sovereign. I know God is sovereign. But that's not the answer to this question. It may be God's sovereignty that there'll be no conversions here. It may be that God has determined for a time of judgment. It may be that if you had Spurgeon and Whitfield roll into one preaching here, they'd see no conversion. It may be. But that's a secret thing I have no idea about. That's God's mind. All I know is, I must cry out to God. Why? Search me. I like Whitfield preaching. He was preaching to a class of young ladies. Amazing for this little man. He was preaching to this class of young ladies. And he said, I've come to marry you to Jesus Christ today. They were looking for husbands, you see. He said, I've come to marry you to Jesus Christ today. That was his sermon. He wanted to marry them to Christ. He wanted to see them converted, he meant, of course. And he says this, I have to go home to my master. What do I tell him? Will you come? And all the rest of it. He realized he had to answer to God. Consider your ways, says Haggai to these people. Think about it. Well, my friend, if we look at the text in verse 5 and 6, I'm afraid it rings too many chords and or rings too many bells. I mixed up my metaphors. It rings too many bells with me. I mean, we have planted much. We have eaten. We have, in the spiritual sense, and we have reaped so precious little. Why, Lord? I gave a paper at the Banner of Truth Conference in 1993, and I opened with Richard Baxter. Richard Baxter said, I marvel at so many reverend gentlemen, he said, he was being a bit ironical, so many ministers can stand and preach for years and years, he said, and see no success. He said, I couldn't do it. Imagine a fisherman going out day after day and catching no fish. Imagine a farmer sowing seed every March and reaping nothing in September. Imagine it year in, year out. Imagine a huntsman going out shooting and he never comes home with a deer or whatever it is to eat. Imagine a minister preaching and never seeing a conversion. My friends, we're in those sorts of conditions today. It should grieve us. Consider. Give careful thought for your ways. I do not know, my friend. The people were saying here, it's our affairs, it's our business, it's our life. That's what our concerns are. Their eyes were on themselves and their things and not on God. I don't know if that's a challenge to you. Andrew prayed in the service for various things, and one was, some of us might need a rebuke. Is there a rebuke there? Haggai could say directly to the people, this is the cause of it in your case. You've shut me out. Now, I don't know if that's the cause. I know there are many sincere people who have given their all for Christ and still see no success. It may be, you see, that secret thing that God has gone out in judgment against us. It may be that's the answer. But I still believe God wants us to say to him, please give me children or I die. And God will reply to us, well, there are things to be done. Verse 7, go up into the mountains and get this and do this. Now, I don't know what has to be done. I am not a prophet. But can we not consider our ways? What can we do before God? What can we do? Maybe all we can do is to pray. I do not know. But is there anything we can engage in? I mean, they're building a physical temple, so they've got to get stones and timber. We can see it. We're not talking about the building this morning, are we? We're talking about spiritual things. Lord, show me. That was Wesley's hymn. I chose it. I don't think I've ever sung it before. May have sung it in another version. I don't know. Search me in this. Show me that, but then show me the answer. Show me my sin, but then show me my Saviour. It's a nice thought, isn't it? Lord, is there anything we can do? Is there anything we should do? Is there anything we should stop doing? But Lord, we must tell God that we do not like it as it is. I know I've used this before, but it's true. A man said, these pews I can make no impression on them, but they make an awful impression on me. We want this place filled, don't we? I mean, I used to picture, if I told you my dreams, what I had, but let us have a vision. I know it's a accommodation of the text. Where there is no vision, the people perish. But some of you may be saying, and I've said it here in this pulpit, so I know it's true. I know I could produce men to stand in this pulpit who would not preach on the prophet Haggai today. There is no need. The prophet Haggai does not apply to them at all. Because they're having so much success that they could not possibly, well, they literally have not got room enough to contain it. We know of places like that, don't we? What do I say to that? Well, I think there's a little test in this text. And I look at verse 9, for example. Verse 9. God says to these people, you had what you thought was much. You expected much. Turned out to be little. And what you had, and it's a picture of grain, isn't it? You brought it to me and I did this. And it all went away. Now again, if I offend you by this, needlessly I am sorry. But I've got to use my judgment. If I thought the secret of this business was with what is going on in these places, I should be there to catch it and to find it. But I fear. I fear that all that glisters is not gold. What am I trying to say? I know we can go to places where the house is packed with activity and seeming thriving churches. But I can only use my judgment, and forgive me if I offend you so badly, I don't mean to. But in my judgment as I see it, I am not impressed by the so-called spirituality of what I see. That is not what I am looking for. I am looking for churches that know Acts 2:42. They continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine, in the breaking of bread, in fellowship, and in prayer. When the prayer meeting is heaving, when there is spiritual fellowship and conversation and sharing of the gospel mutually among us, when I see the Lord's table so precious, where Christ is revealed in such a way that our hearts are broken for him and with him, and when there is such power in the apostolic teaching, then my heart will leap. But I do not see it. Others might. To their own master they stand or fall. But the text that drives itself into my mind is that which I have preached in this pulpit, 1 Corinthians 3. Here, Haggai, God, through Haggai, uses the picture of grain, blowing the husk away. But the one in 1 Corinthians 3 is the one of fire, testing the impregnability of the work. And you remember the illustration the Paul uses, the precious stones, the gold, the silver, and of course there's the wood and the hay and the stubble. I hope you understand me, my friend. I am not appealing for a wooden hay stubble church. I am appealing for a gold, silver, precious stones, granite church. I don't want God to blow it away as all froth, nor do I want God's fire to burn it up. I'd rather have few that are gems than many which are froth. So I'm not appealing just merely for activity-itis, as it were, and sheer numbers. I long that God shall build his temple again, and a temple it ought to be, a spiritual building for God, not a social building for him. I hope I make myself clear. I do not know God, whether God has withheld his blessing from us, as he did with these people, verse 10 and 9, because they had left his house to be a ruin, and therefore he had withheld his blessing from them. I do not know that. It's true for us. But I think we should consider our ways and look for God to bless us in it. But I will just go on and say a few words about the last part of the chapter. The wonderful thing for this man is that God blessed his word to this people, and they heard it, and they responded to it. Verse 12, they obeyed the voice of the Lord their God and the message of the prophet Haggai. Now there's another mark that I want to see in myself, first of all, but in those to whom I preach. I don't know if you ever read Thomas Hardy, but in the Mayor of Casterbridge, in the chapels in those days, in the churches in those days, they had a gallery with a little band. They had no organs, they had a little band up there. After the service, the worthy local worthies of the village at Casterbridge would gather in the tavern and have a pint. But thus, they used to gather to discuss. And what did they discuss? They discussed the sermon. And Hardy records this. Now, Hardy must have seen this in Dorset. He must have watched the villagers do it. And he overheard these men in his villages, when he was a boy, he must have heard them discussing the sermon. I can't quote the exact words now, but it's something like this. They discussed the sermon that morning, whether it was just a bit above usual or just a bit below. But Hardy notices it's this, as something that is detached from them. In other words, they discussed it as a kind of performance. The thought that God might speak to them and challenge them and change their life by this sermon never entered their head. You see this word obeyed here. They obeyed. They didn't go home and say that was a very good sermon or that was a very bad sermon. There's nothing wrong with that, of course. It is good or bad. That's good. That's right. They didn't go home and say, I like that point here. That was a good point there. They went home and did the thing. Now that's the guts of... That's the heart of the thing. Sorry, pardon me for that. But that's the heart of the thing, isn't it? That's the center of the thing. The people changed their life by it. God changed their life by it. That's what I'm looking for in preaching. For me. I know a man who heard, quite an important man amongst the Grace Baptists. And he was preaching on Romans 12. I beseech you by the mercies of God that you present your bodies a living sacrifice. And I asked my friend, how did he get on? And I knew what he was going to say as soon as he started his sentence. What is the worst thing he could say? It was a very poor sermon as far as he was concerned. Why? Because it did not touch him. He came away unscathed. My friend, there's not one of us should come away unscathed from Romans 12:1. None of us should be able to read Romans 12:1 and come away untouched. I beseech you, therefore, my brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice. I fall short on that, and I know you do. I know Paul did. I know we all fall short of it. And if we can sit under a sermon when God says to us, I want everything, your whole body, soul and mind, because of my mercy to you, if we can come away and not feel, oh dear, what do I need to do? Something's wrong with that sermon. You see what I'm trying to say, my friend? We want sinners, don't we, to come under such conviction of sin. We want saints to feel that power of the Spirit too. And the people, verse 12, feared the Lord. Again, I go back to what I was saying just now about the heaving masses. When I've attended such places and looked into such places, I am not struck with the sense of godly fear. It does not strike me. Something else strikes me, godly familiarity. But these people feared the Lord. One of the greatest things you can put on a man's testimony in his death, my friend, this man feared God. Fear God, then you will have nothing else to fear. If I should say to a preacher, a young man starting out, what's his greatest need? Well, you perhaps can't put it into one sentence, but one central part of it will be, you get such a fear of God that you don't fear the people. These people feared the Lord. And God promised to be with them. Now there's hope, isn't there? The church is never so in ruins, never so cast down. The people of God are never so backsliding. People are not so far off from God that he does not know how to rescue and he turns his back upon us. I am with you. Can we not argue with God and plead with God that he would manifest his presence among us? So the Lord stirred up the spirit of these men and they began the work of the house of the Lord Almighty. And in a very short time, God blessed their labors and the work began and continued. It's not the end of the story. There's another chapter to come. In a few weeks' time, I'm with you again and we'll go on to the next section. We see that they need further encouragements and they get it. We're not finished, you see, my friend. Even if this morning we should come to the place where we examine ourselves and return to the Lord our God and dedicate ourselves again to him. And even if the Lord should begin to bless us, that wouldn't be the end of the story. It would only be the beginning of it. We should need another sermon next week to challenge us again and move us on further. It's a lifelong business, my friend, isn't it? It's a lifelong process. I don't know whether I convey to you the spirit of Haggai 1. I can feel it in my own bones. I wish I felt the power of it. I believe it's a sermon, a passage which needs to be faced today by God's churches, by Christians, by me. I suppose it's the psalmist saying, will you not revive us again? Will you be angry with us forever? Or are you going to turn your back upon us forever? We've turned our back upon you perhaps. Well, forgive us for that, but come back to us. And help us to come back to you. You expected much. Well, I've expected much. Shall I tell you how much I expected? Maybe I've told you before. When we started at Lowestoft, I did not want a church of 500. There you are. That was one figure I had in my mind. I know men who want churches of 500. I didn't. I wanted one of 50 and nine more. I wanted 10 of 50. In all the villages around Lowestoft, you won't know their names, it doesn't mean anything to you. But there was no gospel witness, I could say, in all those villages. And I wanted, when I finished now, to look back and see 10 churches of 50. I expected much and got nothing very nearly. Have you got an expectation? Let's have an expectation. Let's pray that God will do it. As I say, His sovereignty may have decreed judgment for us. But we don't know that. And there's no good waiting to find out, because God won't tell us. Let's go on pleading with Him, changing our lives and searching, seeking after Him and searching ourselves and turning to Him and crying out to Him for His blessing. I don't know if it made any sense to you this morning, but I hope it'd be a challenge and a blessing to you. I hope I haven't offended you, because I'm the first one in the list to receive this. I need this, even if you don't, but I'm sure we all fail. We need something of it. Lord, stir our spirits up. Well, shall we sing our last hymn?